Congressman Rodney Davis serves the 13th District in Illinois. Congressman, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Let's start with the House plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. Are you supporting the American Health Care Act as written?
Well, as written, yes, I am. I don't think anybody, including me, thinks that it won't be changed as it goes through the legislative process. I'll monitor those changes. I was very pleased that we were able to put a plan out there for debate in a transparent manner, unlike what we saw when the Affordable Care Act was put into place. This is less than 200 pages. It's actually about 160 pages, easy to read, and also available at readthebill.gop. So make sure you go take a look at it. And then you can also look at some of the, CBO scores and others that have been put out since then and offer up some good suggestions for us so we can make it work and make it better.
Okay. You're a little off mic there. So, how is this an improvement over the Affordable Care Act?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that the status quo, the Affordable Care Act, it's collapsing. In 2 years, under the existing law, the state of Illinois is going to have to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars for an already planned reduction in Medicaid reimbursements. The individual marketplace, the second bucket within the ACA, is in a death spiral. We've seen premium increases in my district upwards of 87%, and that's with plans that require $6,000 deductibles. And then when you look at the third bucket, which is the employer mandate, Zeke Emanuel, the mayor's brother, who actually was one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, he even states in his book, and he stated numerous times, he expects the employer marketplace to be gone by the year 2025. They designed it to collapse. It happened before I got to Washington. And if we didn't look at trying to fix it by repealing and replacing it with something better, then I'd be abdicating my responsibility as an elected policymaker.
A lot of analysts disagree with the term total collapse. They say, yes, it needs fixing, but it has insured a lot more people. The premiums have gone up less than they have at any time since the 1960s. So isn't it worth fixing on its face? What's the most important objection you have to the ACA? Is it the individual mandate? Is it the exchanges? Is it the Medicaid expansion? What's the deal breaker for you?
Well, first off, I disagree with your statistics. An 87% increase is not something that's historically insignificant for anyone. I have problems with the individual portion of the Affordable Care Act, where we've seen many folks who have access to coverage but can't afford to use their coverage. We have 31 million people in this country right now who cannot afford to use the coverage they have. I've been touring and speaking with many healthcare professionals throughout the entire healthcare delivery system. And just today, I've already visited three hospitals to talk about the ACA and talk about healthcare reform. And what we're seeing is an increase in write-offs from those facilities of insured care, patients that can't afford to actually pay the bill even though they're covered. And when you look at the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, and their initial scores of the ACA before I got to Washington, they projected over 20 million people to get coverage through the exchanges. And frankly, what they've seen is about 12 million. So we don't have as many people covered as what was projected. And frankly, still have, at this point in time, I believe the figure is 19 million people that have chosen not to get coverage and either pay the fine that the individual mandate requires, but in many cases, they don't pay the fine or they ask for a waiver from the IRS. So when a plan is designed to be paid for by penalties that aren't collected by the IRS, aren't enforced by the IRS, then how is that system going to survive? How is it not collapsing when the revenue sources that it's supposed to be using with higher coverage, fines when you don't buy coverage, when that revenue is not coming to fruition.
So why not fix the market trends rather than tossing the whole thing out? It did
ensure
20 million and 9 million people enrolled just this year.
Much less than what was anticipated enrolled. 31 million people, again, 10% of our population, may be enrolled, may be covered, but they can't afford to use the coverage they have because there's no affordable options. And what we're trying to do, Charlie, is actually fix it. But you've got to repeal parts of the law that are actually on the books and replace it with something new. Repeal and replace is fixing the law. And I've got a history of actually fixing Obamacare. My Hire More Heroes Act that incentivizes small businesses to hire more of our veterans actually has become law. It passed unanimously. And those are the types of fixes I've been looking at throughout my time in Congress. But we have to make sure that we fix this law by repealing and replacing it with something that's better, provides more affordable options, so that we can have more than 9 million people enjoy coverage that they can actually afford to use.
The Congressional Budget Office report indicates the GOP bill would add 24 million uninsured by 2026 and 14 million alone next year, but save $337 billion in federal spending. How do you balance that and the other trade-offs that the American Health Care Act contemplates?
And the CBO talked about lower premiums. The CBO talked about reducing the deficit. What we have to do is look at our plan in its totality. Because of arcane Senate rules, to be able to get a majority vote in the Senate, we had to run this repeal and replace through the same process that the Obama administration and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi used to actually implement it. It's called budget reconciliation. There are certain rules of what can be in the bill, what can't be in the bill, and that's what we put together with the American Health Care Act. Now, we've got two other buckets that we're going to use, two other portions of our overall healthcare reform that the CBO can't score, that we're going to be able to utilize as part of making coverage more accessible and affordable for all Americans. And that's through the regulatory process, through the HHS and Secretary Price, and also implementing new conservative ideas that President Trump and all of us campaigned on, which is allowing more nationwide access to more options. And that's going to provide Americans with cheaper alternatives. And in many cases, it's going to provide Americans with an alternative, because right now, one third of the country, Charlie, has one insurance provider on the exchanges. That's unacceptable. That's not going to lower premiums. That's not going to lower prices. And that's not going to help them afford to be able to use the coverage they can purchase.
What does market stabilization efforts from Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price look like? What kinds of administrative provisions are going to complement the act as introduced in Congress?
Well, number one, he's going to be able to work with insurers to ensure that they can offer competitive prices and competitive products out into the marketplace. Also, if you have talked to many hospital administrators like I have and I'm doing today, you're going to see that the regulatory environment with the Affordable Care Act, with our healthcare delivery system, it needs to be reined in. Compliance measures are adding to the cost of healthcare for every person who receives it. Doctors are seeing less patients because of compliance measures put forth by the federal government that the HHS secretary can help to rein in, make more manageable, and allow for our medical professionals to actually see patients and lower the cost of healthcare in this country.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with U.S. Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville, who represents a chunk of Bloomington Normal. Engaging the winners and the losers under the GOP proposal, older Americans of a given income would have to pay a lot more than under the ACA. Younger Americans of the same income would pay a little less than under the ACA. What's the reason for that policy preference?
Well, those are projections by the Congressional Budget Office that I will remind you has been wrong about the initial Affordable Care Act. And frankly, I have been wrong about other proposals too. I'll give you one example. I helped write the 2014 Farm Bill. And in that bill, which is 80% food and nutrition, SNAP benefits, we introduced new conservative policy changes that we said was going to save a lot more than that. And they said, no, you're going to save $23 billion in mandatory spending. Happened to be the largest single mandatory spending cut we saw in my first term. But in reality, in the last 3 years, we've saved the American taxpayer because of policy changes, words on pieces of paper that we changed in Washington that the CBO didn't score correctly. We've saved $104 billion. That's real money, even in Washington, D.C. So those, when you look at the CBO scores that don't take into account all three measures that we're pushing with health care reform, I don't necessarily believe that we're going to see spikes in premium increases, no matter what age. And I actually think you're going to see more affordable coverage because Americans can't afford what they're seeing right now of upwards of 87% increases in their premiums and coverage.
Republicans were quite insistent about waiting for the CBO scores under the ACA before moving the bill forward, but they're moving the bill forward under the American Health Care Act with even prior to the CBO scores coming out. And now you're questioning CBO scores, whereas before
I question CBO scores on a wide variety of issues.
It just seems like it's not the same. You're not treating it the same as 6 years ago.
I wasn't there 6 years ago, so I don't know how they were treating it. But I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that both sides use CBO scores to their political advantage. But in reality, we're doing what the American people have asked us to do. There were Republicans in Congress before I got there in 2013 that campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare. In 2012, I did. In 2014, I did. In 2016, I and President Trump did. And now we're actually putting forth our plans in a very transparent manner, and you will never hear a Republican or a member of our Republican leadership team say that we've got to pass the bill to find out what's in it, like Nancy Pelosi said just a few short years ago when passing the ACA.
Many policy experts suggest health care is a pay-me-now or pay-me-later proposition. If those $24 million in the Congressional Budget Office estimate do drop off the insurance rolls, doesn't that toss them back to the emergency room and force health care system costs up again?
How many are not insured now under the ACA, Charlie? See, but I think the CBO and your statement there are assuming is that everybody's insured right now, that everybody's buying insurance. And my figures that I've seen show 19 million people don't have insurance. I believe that for the 5 million that they estimate may not have coverage, we're going to be able to provide them with coverage. Many people who choose not to buy insurance were completely happy with their options before the ACA and now can't afford the options that they've been given. So they're choosing not to have coverage. Those are the choices that we're going to allow them to make in a more affordable manner when we allow for better products, more choices, more opportunities within the insurance market that the CBO is never going to score in our favor. We're going to put our plan out, and it's there. We're going to offer changes to that plan over the next few weeks, and I would urge anyone listening to your show that has any opinions about those changes to call our offices and let us know.
How will lower premium subsidies, though, and lowered penalties for not enrolling not affect enrollment and the risk pool?
Because we're going to provide better options that are not going to be part of our top-down approach that we see with the ACA, Charlie, that are going to allow individuals to actually afford coverage. Think about this. Right now, under the existing system, small business owner in Taylorville, Illinois, where I live, family of four, two infants. His premiums went up from $600 a month to $1,100 a month. And that's with $6,000 deductibles. So basically what he's paying for under the current system is a catastrophic plan that costs him $13,000 a year out of pocket. And then he has to pay another $6,000 to start using that plan. That's why you talk to hospital administrators, Charlie, and they will tell you they are writing off more insured debt than ever before the ACA. So when we still have people choosing not to get insurance, and the IRS, when we hear the individual mandate is collecting that revenue, they're not. The IRS is not enforcing the individual mandate. So people aren't buying insurance and they're telling the IRS they're not paying the fine. So there's no revenue source to continue a collapsing plan, and we as policymakers have to make it better. And I believe the American Health Care Act, when implemented fully, will provide better options and cheaper options for all Americans.
If those people, though, would choose not to pay for insurance because there is no more individual mandate, and if younger, healthier, lower-income people choose not to enter the market or re-enter the market because of that 30% surcharge, how is that not taking a lot of those people out of the insurance market?
Well, it's because we're going to allow them opportunities to get back into the insurance market, remember.
With lower subsidies, though.
The government subsidies, as we've seen, do not necessarily translate into people buying coverage. Keep that in mind when you look at the statistics of what was projected to be of what the number projected to be covered under the ACA. That's less than half in reality of who actually are covered, subsidies or not. And many middle-class Americans don't qualify for subsidies. Our subsidies are going to be in the form of tax credits. And that many middle-class Americans who are struggling to actually purchase the insurance that they can't even afford to use right now are going to be able to get lower premiums and more options. And that, Charlie, is going to allow for more stable insurance markets, more stable patient doctor-centered healthcare decisions to be made, and a better system all around that I believe is going to be more accessible and more affordable, because many of the assumptions you're making are assuming that every single person is actually buying coverage today, and that's just clearly not the case. And you're assuming the individual mandate's being collected, and it is not. So the system set up is collapsing because the system set up is not being enforced by the federal government as it was intended.
Isn't at least a significant portion of the premium increase, though, because the number of invisible, sick, and uninsured were underestimated with the ACA originally?
Well, I don't believe that.
Aren't providers adjusting premiums to reflect the actual costs of caring for the formerly uninsured?
Providers are pulling out because there haven't been enough people signing up for coverage under the exchanges. When you look at the healthcare delivery system in this country, Charlie, we have a problem where there aren't as many options as there were before to actually get coverage in an affordable manner. Remember the promise that was made by President Obama that the average American family was going to save $2,500 in premiums on a regular basis. That clearly didn't happen. In Illinois, our premiums are averaging 45 to 55%, and I've even told you about an 87% increase. Less options don't help those who are actually looking to afford to purchase healthcare coverage. And if we continue down the current path, Illinois is going to have to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars to keep the Medicaid system in place as is because of the existing laws, reduction in federal reimbursements. So the system itself needs to be addressed, and that's exactly what we're doing. And we're going to put forth better ideas that are going to allow Americans cheaper access and better coverage.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Congressman Rodney Davis. Well, let's talk about Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Medicaid, federal support for the Medicaid expansion was due to tail off, as you noted, but block grants to Medicaid are also likely, according to the CBO, to curtail what states do over time. How is that any different?
Well, first off, let's talk about what our goal is with Medicaid. I never understood as a conservative policymaker, Charlie, that our goal was to add more people to our Medicaid rolls. Our goal should be to get people into the jobs, good-paying careers, to allow them to not have to qualify for Medicaid and get them employer-based coverage that in most cases is much better than what we're seeing with Medicaid.
But there's no employer mandate anymore to provide that care under the
employer mandate was not was not a driver in employers providing care, Charlie. The employer marketplace was where most people got their coverage before the ACA, and it's where most people get their coverage now, regardless of the mandate. What you saw is small employers not want to grow their business to be able to provide jobs because they were about ready to be penalized if they were going to go over the 50 employee limit. Keep in mind, this employer mandate double counted many individuals. Think about this. The employer mandate under the Affordable Care Act would count you here. And in my case, my employer mandate counts me. And even though my wife is on my ACA coverage, because as a congressman, I have to buy my coverage through the ACA, she is still counted at her job. So there's this employer mandate was implemented in a way that didn't drive more people and more companies to offer coverage. And frankly, what the ACA has done has made the cost of that employer coverage for many who would have had cheaper options. We watched that go up. You go talk to school districts. Go talk to other employers who have been doing everything they could to provide good alternatives for access to affordable health care. And we've seen those premiums go up, and that promise that the president made that the ACA was going to bring $2,500 of savings just did not happen.
Medicaid, though, is not a recognition of what society should be doing to get people into jobs. It's a recognition of their current incomes.
It is, and our goal should be to raise their current incomes, and that hasn't been the case with anemic 1.8% economic growth under the Obama administration.
But the goal is to actually help preserve their employability by making sure their health needs are taken care of. That's the goal of Medicaid.
And that's why we have to focus on those who need the assistance the most. As we travel around talking to our healthcare professionals, we have to understand, too, that Medicaid is not paying for a lot of those services that are being provided right now. Those who are on Medicaid sometimes find it very difficult to actually go get that care that we're talking about that's going to make them healthier and make them more employable. We have to make sure that we put some accountability measures within our Medicaid system so that we ensure that those patients get access to the care that they need rather than having to go to the emergency departments. And we can do that when the states have the flexibility to actually offer better plans, more flexible plans, that many states, even outside of Illinois, have already done under the current system. But remember, not having any system in place that's going to watch the growth and curtail the growth in money that's being spent is a system that is not going to be sustainable as we move into the future, Charlie. And that should be our goal, and that's the goal of our changes within the American Health Care Act.
Health care costs are national, just as insurance companies are national. Is it a better goal to have the states do it or to have the nation do it in terms of Medicaid?
Well, we think it's much better to have the states do the implementation of most federal programs.
Even if it results in unequal levels of coverage and unequal levels of care.
And those are, in what aspects are you talking about, unequal levels of coverage and unequal levels of care?
Unequal levels of eligibility based
on
the individual
rules. When the states that have access to better Medicaid match dollars put more into their system, that's not a reflection of failure at the federal government's part. Maybe it's a reflection of failures at the state legislative branches. We believe, as Republicans, that states can implement programs much more efficiently for their constituencies and much more effectively and much more affordably than the federal government can. The problem with the ACA was so much of a top-down approach. When you look at Medicaid, we need to have more state ingenuity. We need to have more state innovation to make sure that our state officials are the ones making the decisions on how best to serve their population, because they've got to come up with state dollars to match those federal dollars. And frankly, right now, when you look at the backlog of Illinois bills, many hospitals and doctors are not being paid for the care that they've already provided to our Medicare population. And that's unsustainable right now, too.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with U.S. Representative Rodney Davis. Healthcare is the topic. The AMA says millions will lose coverage and is against the bill. The AARP says it will cost more to those enrolled. Prominent U.S. Senate members say the bill is dead on arrival in that chamber. Is that a critical mass of opposition that causes you to question support for this?
Well, every major piece of legislation that I've seen passed over my 4.5 years in Congress, Charlie, has had the same type of opposition, the same type of rhetoric. So our goal is to legislate. And that's part of that's our job. So when we throw a plan out and it gets debated and it gets amended, then we'll see what plan goes to the Senate and hopefully we'll get to the president's desk. I had my first meeting at the White House just last week as part of this new administration, serving under this new administration. And I heard the president personally tell us, his members of the deputy whip team, that he's 100% in favor of the American Health Care Act, and he's going to help us get that bill passed and get it to his desk. So I'm looking forward to working with him and Vice President Pence and their administration on that.
Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas asked House members not to walk the plank for a bill and put the House majority at risk for a measure that doesn't have a chance. What do you think?
You know, I got elected with Senator Cotton. He was a member of the House for one term, a member of my freshman class. I respect his opinion, but all you have to do is look at Senator Cotton's short voting record in the House and see that there were many instances that he didn't vote to support major pieces of legislation. So this is no surprise. But this is something that the president and his team is going to have to be engaged on if they want to see a bill that they support move from the House and through the Senate to get to his desk. And that's an area where he can focus. My job is to put good bills through the House. While I may not agree with every part of this legislation, I believe it's going to be better than the status quo, which is why I'm supporting it.
President Trump promised that everyone would be covered. Does this bill fulfill that?
President Obama promised that everyone would be covered, and if not, we're going to have to pay substantial penalties for not doing so. That's clearly not the case. So sometimes rhetoric on both sides doesn't match up when it comes to the White House, but we are going to give everybody a chance to get coverage because it's going to be affordable for everyone. And those that it's not affordable for, we believe, will be the ones that qualify under Medicaid. So our options absolutely will be much better than what we see with the status quo.
What does the president and vice president, what do they have to do to accomplish this admittedly really heavy lift?
Well, they're already doing that. They're bringing over members of Congress to talk to them about what their concerns are. That's what legislating's all about. I thought I was going to the White House a week ago just to kind of do a grip and grin in a room and a photo op. And I got there and it was a large table with nameplates where the president and vice president wanted to sit down with us without any media in the room after the initial pictures were taken and talk about what our concerns were and tell us that they're there to help us whip this bill and make sure it gets through the House. And then when it gets through the Senate, you know, they're going to work with our U.S. senators to make sure that it gets there. It gets through that chamber, too.
And did he express concerns about the current form?
No. He expressed support for the current version of the American Health Care Act.
And what
he expressed concerns about some of those who were opposing it
and
before it was even there.
What did you tell him about your concerns about its doability or its form?
Well, frankly, and I still believe this, I think we'll be able to get the votes in the House.
As is. One thing you can say is President Obama fully owned the ACA and embraced the phrase Obamacare. Who owns the American Health Care Act? Is it Donald Care, Trump Care, Ryan Care, House Care? Who gets this one?
You know who's going to own the act? It's going to be the American people who are going to benefit from our changes to the status quo. We're going to see more affordable options. We're going to see opportunities for Americans to actually get the coverage that they can afford to use. And we're going to see innovation at the states that are going to ensure that we do everything we can to move people off of government benefits like Medicaid and into jobs that are going to pay them and provide them the health care coverage they deserve.
President Trump has said there would be a bloodbath in 2018 if Congress did not repeal and replace. Any concern there will be an upheaval in the Senate and House if 14 to 24 million people lose coverage?
Well, there's already an upheaval, which is why we've seen Republicans who have campaigned on repealing and replacing this law and providing the fix that they want and they desire. We have 31 million people that can't afford to use the insurance they have. 19 million people in this country that choose still not to purchase any insurance and don't pay the fine of the individual mandate. So the coverage and the projections of 24 million people, you know, we'll wait and see. Time will tell once we implement all of our plans to see how many are actually not able to purchase insurance or choose not to. But what we're going to see, I believe, if we don't live up to our promises of repealing and replacing the system as we know it today as Obamacare, we will see a backlash at the electoral in the ballot box. Absolutely. We have to live up to our promises, and this is our first step in doing so, and I believe it's going to result in better options.
What are you hearing from constituents? How is the mail running?
Well, we hear a lot of those. We hear from a lot of those who are opposed, who think the status quo is working. I clearly don't believe it. We also hear from those who believe the status quo is not working. And I gave you the example of the 87% increase. That's not the only one that we've heard about. There are many, many others. But that's typical. That's what being a member of Congress, you're going to hear on all sides of the issue. What my goal is to talk to those who are affected by the ACA, both in a positive and a negative way. Talk to those who are in an integral part of our healthcare delivery system, medical professionals, hospitals, those who are in state government who are implementing our Medicaid system as we know it today, and getting their ideas on how to make the system better.
The last time you visited GLT, you were unwilling to really talk about what repeal and replace would look like because there was not a bill.
Well, I was more than willing to talk about the framework that we laid out for 6 months prior to the presidential election, and that's how you actually put any piece of legislation together. Now, it's like building a house. You got to have the frame up before you actually go pick out what colors of paint you're going to put in and what color of carpet. You may have some ideas, but until you actually put it into a bill, it's tough to discuss what the details are.
Well, now there's a bill. Are you going to discuss that with the public?
I have, and I will continue to do that.
Will you hold town hall meetings now?
I've never, ever in my career, even when members of my own party were asking me to hold what many would call a town hall, I reach out to constituents and talk with them in venues of all different areas. I've held many teletown halls that reach all 14 counties and thousands more people than would ever have been reached at a town hall event that is being called for by my political opposition.
Why? What's your objection to that format?
Because I don't think it's conducive to solving problems, Charlie. What has happened in the past that I've seen before I got elected and what I've seen since, it becomes a screaming match between those who are opposed of a certain issue and those who are in favor of a certain issue. And they become what I call grandstanding events. And anybody who tries to create a narrative that I'm not accessible, that I don't talk to constituents, and you've known me now for 4.5 years, Charlie, I've always wanted to come here regardless of the issue and talk about where I stand as an elected official.
Members of Indivisible 13 have been meeting with your district staff to try to set up what they call a civil moderated town hall. Is that something that would be acceptable or would be useful in showing you in other than an interview setting?
Well, Charlie, we will continue to offer teletown halls to thousands more people than could ever be reached at a single location in one of the 14 counties, and actually reach out to all of my constituents rather than just a few and many who have always been my political opposition. Remember, many of those who are protesting my stance on the ACA should have known my stance on the ACA when I ran in 2012, 2014, and 2016. It's no surprise that I want to make our system better, and I think the status quo was failing. But many of those same protesters have protested me on a wide variety of issues over the last 4 years.
A lot of these protesters, though, on this issue this time were previously not active.
A lot were.
You know, Democrats said they didn't see the Tea Party coming. They didn't take into account the serious nature of voter anger over the ACA when it passed. How seriously do you take the current distress of progressives over the ACA?
Well, I take any concern from my constituents very seriously, Charlie. But what we're going to do, unlike the Democrats, is we believe we're going to put a system in place that's going to benefit all Americans. And the ACA clearly has not, which is why I believe the status quo is unacceptable.
After one rally calling for a meeting, your staff directed GLT to the RNC instead of handling it locally. Should you, as an elected official, be punting to the RNC?
To the NRCC? When events are clearly political in nature, there are many times that we're going to refer that to the political arm of the Republican of our operation, which happens to be the NRCC at this point. Many of these issues are clearly driven by political politics, similarly to the Tea Party that was driven by many Republican operatives in 2009. It's not rocket science to figure out that you try and emulate what worked. And that's exactly what many on the Democrat side of the aisle are doing. And that's okay.
You met with Tea Party folks, though. Why not meet with
the others? I have, and I do. And the fact that many say that we don't meet with individuals is just clearly wrong. We've given many opportunities, but for some who want to see me lose, whatever I do, Charlie, is never going to be good enough.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with U.S. Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville. What do you think should happen now regarding President Trump's so far unfounded allegations regarding wiretapping?
Well, I think he should provide information to the House Intelligence Committee as they've asked, because it's clearly an allegation that needs to be investigated in a bipartisan way by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
Is that how it should work, though? Allegations get a full House and Senate investigation without,
I think, clearly,
without ponying up support?
That's, I just said, Charlie, his administration should offer up evidence to back up those allegations as requested by the House and Senate and by the House Intelligence Committee. And I don't know if it's been requested by the Senate Intelligence Committee yet.
Should he be making the allegations without proffering support for them in the first place?
Which is exactly why, in a bipartisan way, the House Intelligence Committee has asked for evidence.
If there ends up being no evidence, how much credibility should we give to a statement from the president regarding other events?
Well, I think it's on a case-by-case basis, and you're assuming that there's not evidence.
There's nothing so far, and it's been going on for quite a while.
Well, and that's why the House Intelligence Committee, in a bipartisan way, has asked for that. And the administration's going to have to give that evidence or probably lose some credibility with the American people. But what is interesting is there should be, in any allegation like that, there should be a FISA court trail. If wiretapping or listening was authorized, it should have been authorized and presented as evidence to get a court order from a FISA court judge. Now, if that was not given and evidence is there that the privacy of an American was not respected, that to me is a huge problem. So I'm anxiously awaiting that evidence myself because I want to find out exactly how and why our intelligence agencies thought that this may be a good idea if it happened.
They are at least in hinting that they didn't. The FBI has asked the Justice Department to refute it.
Well, like I said, if there was approved wiretapping of an American citizen in regards to a foreign nation, there should be a paper trail through the FISA court. And if there is, I believe the administration will provide it. If there's not, and there was still evidence of wiretapping or listening devices, that's clearly a problem within the executive branch. It needs to be addressed because the privacy of every American should always be respected.
What if there is neither? Neither a FISA trail nor evidence that there was any wiretapping?
Then the administration is going to have egg in their face.
Well, how do you weigh the president's statements and tweets on this?
Well, I've clearly said numerous times I wish the president would tweet a little less. But remember, this is a president for the first time in our lifetime that has come directly from the private sector. He has a way of doing business, and he believes by tweeting, it's a way to get his message directly to the American people. Clearly worked in the presidential election, and he believes it's working now. Now, if there's no evidence on this issue, then clearly that's a mistake on his part, and I would hope that he was more careful. But if there is evidence, Charlie, if there is evidence that an American citizen and American citizens were spied on, were listened to without the proper authorization, that is a major problem. And that's something that I've been fighting even against my own party in the 4 years that I've served in Washington. I've always been an advocate for privacy. I've always thought the NSA surveillance programs that focus on a needle in a haystack, we did not need to make the haystack grow so big that you could never find the needle. And I'm clearly on record of supporting privacy rights in the past, and I will continue to be, regardless of whether or not it's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House.
National Security Advisor Flynn resigned over contacts with the Russian government. It looks as though now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, acting as a campaign surrogate, met with the Russian ambassador and was not truthful about it during his confirmation hearing. What role should the House play in getting to the bottom of the contact and its impact?
Well, I'm glad General Flynn resigned. He should have. Clearly, even more evidence about being a foreign, operating as a supporter of a foreign country by consulting like he did with Turkey. It shows that it was a good idea for President Trump to ask for his resignation. Now, let's talk about Senator Sessions. I'm a member of Congress. I sat at the joint session of Congress that President Trump gave a few weeks ago, two seats away from ambassadors throughout the world who were on the House floor. Jeff Sessions was a United States senator and answered, in my opinion, gave the answer to the question that was given. I don't believe Senator Sessions, in his role as a U.S. senator, I believe he's a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, talked about or worked with any Russian official in regards to the political campaign of 2016. He and Democrats, 30 Democrats, met with Russian officials and the Russian ambassador. These are just part of your duty as being an elected official, where you meet with consul generals and ambassadors of foreign nations on a regular basis. And what frustrates me about this is it's a delay tactic that we've seen implemented by the Democrats in the Senate. And it slows down the confirmation process, which slows down the ability of the Trump administration to get their people in place. And that's something that I didn't support when Republicans did it to President Obama. And clearly it's unprecedented what they're doing to President Trump right now. And it's unacceptable, and it should be unacceptable to the American people.
What role should the House play in getting to the bottom of Russian meddling in the election then?
Number one, we've got to have the House and Senate Intelligence Committees look into any evidence as to the role that was played. But I also have faith that our elections are the freest and fairest in the world, and our elections are done at the state level. Our elections are monitored by many good Republican and Democrat county clerks in our 102 counties right here in Illinois, and they do a great job. The only allegation of hacking that I saw of an election system came from our own Department of Homeland Security in a case of an election commission in Georgia. So we've got to look at the evidence that we had a very fair election, that our county officials and our state officials did an excellent job in making sure that took place. And if there's any evidence of meddling in the election, we have to make sure that there's a differentiation between the numbers of people who voted and votes cast and for whom versus the rhetoric and maybe leaks that were put out there as part of WikiLeaks. And that is still a concern. Don't get me wrong, Charlie. I have a concern when any foreign country meddles in our, not just our elections and the votes that are being cast, which we don't see any evidence of here in this country, in 2016 and didn't see any evidence of. But I have a big concern about them meddling in any aspect of our system. And we should be very concerned, not only about Russia, but about many other countries who feel that they can influence the American electorate. And I believe the House and Senate Intelligence Committees will actually get to the bottom of this.
Congressman, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Charlie. Great to see you.
U.S. Representative Rodney Davis serves the 13th Congressional District of Illinois.